Yeah, I just wonder if you could explain or speculate about why there were no, those diagnostics weren't used from 2005 to 2011.
I don't have, you asked me to speculate. The use of the diagnostics is related to nuclear weapons life extension programs. And when life extension programs are not making serious modifications to nuclear weapons, so you're not making changes to the pit or the physics package, as they call it, it is my understanding that the shake and bake diagnostic is less, quote-unquote, necessary. And the more severely you modify the nuclear weapons design in doing a life extension program, it is my understanding that that makes the use of the shake and bake more, quote-unquote, necessary. And also, you know, new pits and new pit technologies when you're producing pits, that could also make it more necessary. So there's a direct connection between use of the diagnostic and the nuclear weapons policy and how much we're making pits and how much we're modifying weapons. And I'm actually in the process of trying to document that further. The DOE Inspector General's report that I quoted from that said they weren't used from 2005 to 2011 did not go into that kind of detail, and so I'm in the process of sort of putting that together.
Next question.
I was wondering if anybody on the panel might be aware of what the shipments were that took place. I think it was in around August of 2011. There were roughly 6 to 8 shipments that left out of the lab around 11:30 to 12, probably around 11:30 at night. At one point, I had gone down to the East Avenue Shopping Center over there. I heard the alarms go off at the lab. About 5 minutes later, a convoy, mammoth truck like that's displayed on your photo there with a huge cask on it, mammoth cask. Highway Patrol, you could tell, was contracted security. They traveled from East Avenue, because I live in Pleasanton, on Old Stanley Boulevard. It was a horrendous first time when they tried to negotiate the turn, but one night he even took the liberty of following it from Pleasanton, through Pleasanton, it got out on Bernal, onto Highway 680, traveled north. I only went as far as San Ramon. That was as far as I could go. The CHP wove back and forth across the freeway, blocking any traffic. You couldn't proceed beyond the mammoth shipment, that truck. It took up the whole freeway. And so I don't know, it was heading north, either towards Sacramento or maybe to San Francisco. Maybe it was going overseas. As I said, there was roughly 6 to 8 shipments. Huge mammoth truck. Does anybody know what that might have been?
No, but I'm very interested. Seriously, there are a couple of possibilities. One, August 2011 was during the active de-inventory process. And while exact amounts and places are supposed to be classified, it's well known that the highly enriched uranium went mostly to 2 sites and the plutonium went mostly to 3 sites. So it could have been some of those shipments. But also, when you said it had huge canisters on it, if you come to the office, I'd like to show you what a true PAC-2 canister looks like. Because those are what are called transuranic wastes, which are mostly plutonium-contaminated waste products, not the plutonium pits, but the waste products from experimenting with plutonium, which ultimately goes to the WIP facility in New Mexico. So I'm not quite sure of why that would be going north.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I would like to show you some pictures of some different kinds of trucks, and maybe we can figure it out. And there's a public relations person from the lab who could maybe get us a better answer.
Any more questions?
In the back.
just curious about our resources to get a well tested, you know, groundwater. How would you go about doing that?
Do you want to answer that, Peter, first?
You're talking about your own well.
Yeah, the water I'm drinking.
The water that you're drinking. Whereabouts?
I'm down Tesla off of Pasadena.
I would suspect that you'd have to go to the Regional Water Quality Control Board.
The what?
The Regional Water Quality Control Board. For more information about getting it tested. Unless Marilyn, do you have any ideas about that?
That's a good place to start. Depending on where you are, vis-a-vis the Alameda County line and the San Joaquin County line, depending on which side of the county line you're on.
Alameda County.
Okay, then it would probably be the Regional Water Quality Control Board office in Oakland. And I can get you the number if you have trouble finding it when you look it up. And that would be a good place to start.
Regional Water Control
Board. Regional Water Quality Control Board. Okay. And if you don't remember it, just call me.
Okay. More questions?
Joanne.
The route between Los Alamos and Livermore will go through many cities that have millions of people that are potentially going to be exposed to the possibility of some kind of accident, terrorist attack, or whatever. And also some of these areas that the route will go through, I'm sure, are declared nuclear-free zones. What can we do, and what legally will they do or have to do to make sure that everyone along that route knows what's happening? I realize because of the sensitivity of it, they might not want to broadcast which day and hour they're going to be coming through the city, but at the same time, I would think that the authorities should know when those shipments are coming through their cities and towns. So how do you approach that kind of thing to make sure that people are aware of what they are potentially being exposed to?
Well, there are a couple of answers. In terms of a community being a nuclear-free zone, I wish my answer was a little different. And Jackie and Western States Legal Foundation have worked on this with respect to Oakland's nuclear-free zone. But it's difficult to prevent the federal government from going through your community with nuclear weapons materials, even if you are a nuclear-free zone. There's a sort of federal preemption, if you will. But your bigger question is really about the rights of the people all along the route. And one of the things I hope that we talk about in the organizing, little breakout discussion group, is contacting environmental groups and that we know of, and people we know of, who live up and down I-5 and live in these other communities, and get them petitions, or maybe they want to go to their city council and get them actually involved in the question of full-on plutonium bomb pits rolling through their communities. So and through the environmental impact statement process, we would also be demanding hearings in those communities, no matter what is decided, because all of the people have a right to be part of the decision making. And I think that's what's ultimately going to influence the final decision, is whether people are actually, finding their voice and having their voice in the decision.
I'll give you a little bit of an indirect answer, but I'll repeat, I think you all can win this issue. Without that much difficulty. Now, what I don't want to do is make you all think that you don't have to do anything. I'm arguing the opposite. You have to do a whole lot, and you need to do it quickly, and you need to do it strongly. But this is a winning issue. And then what I'm falling back on is Scott's a lawyer, and wouldn't you know it, he starts talking about the law, and specifically the National Environmental Policy Act, which Mira Lea also just now mentioned. Now, the federal government, it's a federal law, but that's not to say that the federal government particularly likes NEPA. And in the quote old days, it used to be pretty easy to beat them on NEPA. And we beat them up a lot, too, with NEPA comments. So the government, over time, has grown far more sophisticated in meeting the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law. But again, you know, I'm going on my gut instincts here. I think you all have a winning issue. And so you get into this NEPA business, and you make the federal government aware of the fact that it has a fight on its hand on this issue, and that it has to go through the full legally required process under the National Environmental Policy Act. And you know, I am so rash as to try and make a prediction, but you all put up a stiff fight, make a big stink. You know, media work too is coupled with it, but also the stuff under the National Environmental Policy Act. And see, you already, we know, Mira Lea and I know that from our visits in Washington just 2 weeks ago, that the government itself is conflicted about shipping plutonium to Livermore. So if you exploit that conflict that we already know is within the federal government, you're going to win on this. And NEPA will be one important piece of it. And of course in NEPA, it should address, and you have to make the government do it, but it should address fully the transportation concerns that you mentioned, coupled with, boy, this is a chance to toot our horns, right? Which we should always seize the opportunity to toot our horns, and I almost forgot. But Nuke Watch and Tri-Valley Cares were involved in litigation. And it was litigation under the National Environmental Policy Act on biological weapons agents labs at both Livermore and Los Alamos. And we seized upon Mothers for Peace, right? Is that their name?
Yeah,
in San Luis Obispo.
Yes.
It was Mothers that originally...
Mothers for Peace.
Okay. I was going Mothers of Invention. But anyway, Mothers for Peace. They provided a great precedent for the, is it San Onofre or Diablo?
Diablo Canyon.
It was Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant. But a great legal precedent in that post 9/11 under NEPA that federal agencies had to consider terrorist attacks. And then Nuke Watch and Tri-Valley Cares applied that in our lawsuit concerning Department of Energy bioweapons agents facilities. But it became a federal requirement to address the possibility of terrorist attacks as well. And, you know, believe me, that's a sticky wicket post 9/11. So in any event, once again, you know, go full bore on the NEPA requirements. Scott alluded to this, but it's one of the few tools or handles that citizens actually have and can use to impact federal policy.
Yeah, this is a question and a statement. And it's about the NEPA scoping process, which is very important, because I suspect that the shake and bake is not the only thing that's going to happen with that plutonium. It's not going to be a truck that's going to be unloaded to the shake and bake and then receive it when it passes its test. There are going to be other kinds of experiments, and we need to know that. there are going to be storage requirements. We need to know that, because in my, I did a study for Tri-Valley Cares on plutonium use at the lab in 2002. There were 30 documented releases of radioactive materials by accident. There were another 60 documented vulnerabilities that could have led to releases. So there's it's an enormous problem, and I think that we should know as much as we can about what they're planning to do with these pits. In the process, do they scrape a little bit off?
I can partially answer that. So here's what I've been told so far, and I hope that you're getting the idea that we're telling you one of the problems is that the Department of Energy has allowed itself, or been allowed, to keep this plan rather vague and amorphous, so they can do whatever they want without a full documented analysis. So when I ask, what do you do? So the shake and bake, the drop test, the thermal unit, and the shaker table, I was told would use the full pits. And that they would probably be here for up to a month, one government official told me. So, and then after the shake and bake, you do, and actually Don Cook talked to Jay and I about this.
Who's Don Cook?
I'm sorry. So Dr. Don Cook is the head of DOE NNSA defense programs. He is the person, the federal person most in charge of this decision. And he was, because we asked him, was talking to us about how then you would do materials characterization and analytical chemistry is what they call it. So you would take samples off of the plutonium bomb cores and you would look carefully at how they withstood these tests, what changes were or were not in the plutonium. It is not entirely clear to me, because the government has gotten away without doing any environmental impact statement or even giving Congress the detailed plan that Congress asked for. It is not entirely clear to me whether that analytical work would happen at Livermore, and then they would take the pits back to Los Alamos, or whether they would take the pits back and do the analytical work there. These are the kinds of questions that we deserve answers to, and getting a full analysis is the way to get the answers.
I see two more questions. I'll take those as the last, and then get us the groups.
You may have covered this already. I came in late, but my question is, does anyone here know the time frame or timeline of when they plan to decide to move these pits from Los Alamos to Livermore Lab? We're talking about building a public campaign against this. That'd be very important to know.
In terms of the full pits, they have not said. But there is a Los Alamos Laboratory presentation to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on their plutonium plans. And there's a graph. I've got a bunch of them on the table. You can almost use a magnifying glass, though. The graph says that they're going to start sending plutonium to Livermore's super block in 2014. And So, you know, that may be plutonium that's other than these pits, but plutonium's going to start coming here, according to their plans, fairly quickly. If you do a full environmental impact statement, that's a 1 to 2 year process. So they need to be doing it now. If you're going to make plans to decommission and not use this technology anymore, that means a thorough evaluation. You have to start that now. If you're planning to move it to where the pits are, you can't do that overnight. You need to start doing that analysis and that evaluation now. So really what we're calling on them to do is good planning, which takes time. And if you wait, if we wait until the pits are about to be put on the trucks and brought here, then it's too late. So in terms of the alternatives, now is when they need to be putting the plan on the table in detail and soliciting our public comment on it. And so now is when we need to be organizing in our own community and in other communities.
Hi, I'm in the last hour and a half, I'm lost in the terminology and of what we're talking about. But so pits, right? It's not like a fruit pit, or it's not like something you fall into. It was plutonium bomb core. And this is the very end of what happens when a nuclear weapon goes off, right? This is the thing that detonates and...
The question was essentially, what's a plutonium pit? And I'll start off, I'll mention that I went to Russia in 2000, and I had a fact sheet on plutonium pits translated into Russian before I went. And it's a town in Southeast Urals that both Marilee and I have been to on different occasions, Chelyabinsk. But in any event, I'm giving my rap and referring to my fact sheet while it's being translated there. But again, my fact sheet was already translated into Russian. And then I realized that the Russians, my colleagues, were all looking up very, very puzzled. And I'm wondering what's going on, and oh my God, I'm such a bad speaker and all that stuff. But it finally became clear that the word pit had gotten mistranslated in my fact sheet. And pit got translated as, you know, a hole in the ground. But instead, what we're talking about, and Marilee did say, you know, the pit of an apricot. I like peaches better, so I say the pit of a peach. But that's what it is. We're talking about the inner core. Now, you also asked, is it like the final phase or whatever of a modern thermonuclear weapon? And no, it's not. It's actually the initiating phase. That's why they're called triggers. But be clear on the fact that they are a weapon unto themselves. They are what destroyed Nagasaki. And they are what, you know, the amazing, and listen to me, I'm saying this, the amazing technical feat that Los Alamos and the Manhattan Project achieved was in scratch designing and producing a plutonium pit in basically 2.5 years, including, you know, producing the plutonium itself. So these guys were giants that, you know, conserved taxpayers' money doing this incredible feat during World War II. We have to admit, technically it is. But I'm using this to also denigrate present weaponeers who are just sucking up the money to do this technology that's already 60 years mature. But pits are triggers, and they fission, and through that initiate fusion in the secondaries. And the secondaries are what put the H and H bomb, the hydrogen, what gives you the immense yields. So there is an all too simplistic description of plutonium pit cores.
And, I'm going to take one final question and lean on the panel for a concise answer to the final question.
Hi, I'm just wondering why the lab lost its security authorization in September.
Okay.
There are a lot of different factors that played into that. I think one central factor was the massive security failure in the force-on-force drills in 2008. Also during that same time, the government was undergoing a process of this complex transformation which had to do with modernizing and consolidating at the same time. So the lab will tell you that it was complex transformation. I will tell you that it was the massive security failure. The reason that the change took place on September 30th, 2012 is that's the end of the government's fiscal year. So they had an internal schedule to get the weapons usable quantities of plutonium and highly enriched uranium out by the end of fiscal year 2012. And the reason that Tom D'Agostino, the head of NNSA, put out the press release on September 21st was to tell that they had actually done it. And, you know, they were 9 days ahead of schedule.